This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The shooting of a 16-year-old black child named Ralph Yarl by an 84-year-old white man named Andrew Lester in Kansas City, Missouri, has renewed calls for gun control and so-called stand your ground laws to be revoked. But it has also brought up the question of violent white supremacist backlash to an increasingly diverse nation. More than 7 years ago, writer and thinker Steve Phillips was among the first to tackle this issue in his book, Brown is the New White: How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority, which went on to become a New York Times bestseller. Phillips's new book is called How We Win the Civil War: Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. He's the founder of Democracy in Color and hosts the podcast Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips. He's also a columnist for The Guardian and The Nation and an opinion contributor to The New York Times. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So I had spoken to you in 2016 when Brown is the New White had, or maybe it was 2015 when it first came out. It was a long time ago. And I remember every time I have thought about the ways in which brown and black folks are entering office and winning victories and going on to strengthen our democracy, I thought of you and the work that you've done. You have a new book out, and I'm wondering, when you wrote Brown is the New White, could you have ever predicted that something like the January 6th riot, which you open your book with, would have happened, this violent insurrection, a violent threat to our democracy?
Well, on the one hand, no, I don't think anybody would have predicted that, because it was in some levels unprecedented in terms of that particular type of manifestation. But if you really look at the history of the country, then actually it's not so surprising. And that was what was illuminating for me in doing the research and the history and then trying to tell the story of this country and how the Confederates have never stopped fighting the Civil War. The Civil War itself began when the candidate who was backed by black people won the election in 1860, and the losing side refused to accept the election results. And rather than accept those results, they seceded from the Union. And that is what laid the seeds for ultimately the beginning of the Civil War in 1861. So in many ways, it's actually not unprecedented, and it was not coincidental that the January 6th insurrection had people carrying the Confederate flag into the Capitol and wearing sweatshirts saying MAGA Civil War, January 6th, 2021.
And we've had in recent years, even leading up to January 6th, this struggle over history, right? The tearing down of, or the criticism over Confederate era statues that remain in the United States, then the right wing attacks on so-called critical race theory, all of which seem to suggest that this narrative around white supremacy has never truly been overturned and challenged, and has made the case, as you make in your book, that the Civil War never really ended. America never truly acknowledged the sin of slavery, never truly acknowledged and reconciled with the white supremacist origins of this nation, right?
Exactly. And so the resistance to the Civil War ending began immediately. And so April 9th, 1865 was the date that Robert E. Lee surrendered, ostensibly. A couple days later, Lincoln gives a speech from the White House where he mentions limited voting rights for African Americans. And John Wilkes Booth is at that speech. The speech was given, you know, outside at the White House. And he turns to a friend and says, "That means N-word citizenship." Mm-hmm. That's the last speech he'll ever give. And then 5 days after the supposed surrender at Appomattox, Wilkes Booth goes into the Ford Theater and shoots Lincoln in the back of the head. That's not surrendering at all. And so then you need to go from that, because you're mentioning all of the statues that were erected. There was a three-story high statue of Robert E. Lee erected in Richmond decades before we were able to actually get the Lincoln Memorial itself created.
And these statues came after the Civil War, which is an indication that they were actually a reaction to try to insist that the war is not over.
Exactly. This whole, we talk now about the big lie and what Trump has been trying to perpetuate, there is precedent in the lost cause mythology where they tried to, and in many ways successfully, recast the Civil War from a rebellion of white supremacist mass murderers to some kind of glorified noble cause for the defending their heritage. So these things have been going on unrelentingly, frankly, since the time of the Civil War and honestly, even before that.
Now, many commentators who are trying to understand the situation that we're in today trace the beginning of the white backlash to Obama's presidency and might argue, well, if the Civil War was never truly won, Obama would never have been able to be elected, and it's, you know, a constant struggle. How do you respond to that?
So that is what we tried to illustrate and outline in the first book, Brown is the New White. And that's frankly why I wrote Brown is the New White, is that because it was clear to me, I mean, I came of age and Jesse Jackson's presidential campaigns was very explicitly connected to Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement and an extension of that movement and that effort, that Obama would not have won election in 1980. He would not have beaten Reagan. Obama could only win in 2008 because the country was more racially diverse.
Oh.
And if you took his formula, his percentages, 40% of white people, 80% of people of color, that was not a majority in 1980 and 1984. It's only as the country has gotten more diverse that it has become a majority of the population. And so that's what people don't understand. And that's when they try to point to make the wrong conclusions about Obama's election. Politics in this country has historically been a battle between white people. And it was conservative whites battling with progressive whites over the whites in the middle. And there were not enough people of color in the country who certainly were able to vote, but really, frankly, even in the country overall, to be able to flip the balance of elections. But that has changed. So people of color were 12% of the population in the 1960s, 40% today. So now people of color and progressive whites alone are the majority of people within the country. That's what propelled Obama to victory. It wasn't that there was some magical realization or awakening about how racism is no longer a factor in the country. It's that the pro-multiracial segment of whites could ally with people of color and elect a black man president.
So let's tease apart this idea that there is basically a battle between democracy and whiteness, and the sort of pro-Trump MAGA conservatives in the United States are choosing whiteness over democracy. That is a stark dichotomy to face. And how do you tease that apart? Because the idea of democracy is rule by people. But if the people themselves are increasingly not white, then we have this crisis of white folks who are very fearful, it seems, of democracy because they're fearful of people of color.
Correct. And so this has been an ongoing thread throughout the history of this country. And it's why one of the staples of the efforts of the original and modern day Confederates has been to suppress democracy, is that you, and it began right after the Civil War and in the Reconstruction era, because in places like South Carolina and Mississippi, black people were the majority of people in those states. So they had to suppress democracy and if they really wanted to preserve white power in those areas. And so that is the title of the introduction, the choice between democracy and whiteness. And it's from a phrase for that Taylor Branch uttered, who was the author of the Parting the Waters civil rights books. And he was talking with Isabel Wilkerson of CAST about the rise in white domestic terrorism under Trump, where you had people who were incited and inflamed, at least, by Trump's rhetoric to carry out white domestic terrorist mass murder, such as at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, in response to all the demonizing of Central American immigrants. They're talking about caravans, et cetera. And White said, Taylor Brandt said, I guess the question is, people had a choice between democracy and whiteness. How many would choose whiteness? And Wilkerson says, we let that one hang in the air, neither of us willing to hazard a guess. But then we had it directly before us on January 6th, where you had 50 states, 50 governors, Republicans and Democrats alike, certify the election results. That's the essence of a democracy. And rather than accept the democratic process and finalize that process to install Joe Biden as president, they stormed the United States Capitol with the Confederate flag to try to stop democracy in its tracks. And so that is not a hyperbolic or theoretical construct. We had an actual situation, and we had many people, including the former president of the United States, directly trying to destroy our democracy.
Now, I'm sure the situation that played out recently in Tennessee is something that you've thought quite a bit about. We had these two young Black lawmakers who were really a testament to the ways in which progressive people of color in general, are entering the political system. And then the clash that we saw when they were ousted unceremoniously by the largely white Republican majority in the Tennessee House of Representatives. Is that clash a playing out of the civil war that you write about?
Absolutely. And it's, again, another attack on democracy. And in democracy, particularly in terms of state legislatures, representatives choose their leaders, send their leaders to the seat of government, and then those leaders are all together debate the policies and priorities for the society. And so what you had was the white-led leadership of the Tennessee state legislature removing the chosen leaders of Nashville and of Memphis without any kind of process at all. So then the people had chosen, we want these people to represent us. And they said, no, we're not going to allow you to be the chosen representative. That's just, again, another outright assault on democracy. But it's not surprising that it took place in a place like Tennessee and in the Tennessee state legislature. So the Tennessee state legislature in the 1970s voted to put in place a bust, a 3,000-pound bronze bust of Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was a slave dealer, a Confederate general, and the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. And then Tennessee state legislature says, we want to honor that man. And we're going to put a bust in the state capitol, the same state capitol for which they expelled the Justins. And they fought for it and defended it for more than 40 years, only removed over great protest after the murder of George Floyd. So Tennessee has a long and ignoble history of officially siding with the causes of white supremacy over multiracial democracy.
So let's talk about the very important part of your book, which is how we build a multiracial democracy. This is something that's already happening. It's in place on the federal level. It's happening on the state level, on the local level, that people of color are increasingly running for office and winning. They have the numbers to support them now, in large part because of the demographic changes that you're talking about. So tell me about this, the action plan, if you will, that you envision for ending white supremacy for good.
And so, yes, the whole second half of my book are case studies of places that have actually advanced white supremacy advanced multiracial democracy over the forces of white supremacy. And I have five different case studies of states and regions that have had significant progress over the past decade. So one of them being Arizona, right, where the very first governor of Arizona had been the editor of a newspaper called The White Man. And it presided over what they called scalp dances, where the people would gather to dance under the scalps of Native Americans who had been killed by the whites trying to colonize that area. And then most significantly, so in Arizona, also they tried to block Martin Luther King's birthday being a holiday. And then most pertinent to the current moment is they passed this anti-immigrant bill, the Show Me Your Papers bill, in 2010, that really empowered local police to serve as, frankly, modern day slave catchers and round people up and ship them out of the country just based upon the suspicion. And it was largely people of color. But that process radicalized and politicized the whole generation of young people, people like Alex Gomez and Montserrat Redondo, who went on to create civic engagement organizations in Arizona, Lucha, One Arizona, Arizona Wins. And those organizations, over the course of a decade, have registered and mobilized hundreds of thousands of people of color, and Latinos in particular, to come into the electorate and change the composition of the electorate. And through that is how you had Biden defeat Trump in Arizona in 2020. You helped to flip the whole US Senate by electing Mark Kelly to the Senate in 2020 and elected a Democrat as the governor, Katie Hobbs, in 2022. So that process of people of color, building civic engagement organizations, increasing turnout of people of color, and then transforming the politics of that state and even the whole country is the formula. And it's a formula that has been proven and it is working across the country.
I'm wondering how the issue of the Second Amendment figures into this whole thing, because we have a country where conservative minority is increasingly armed, and, you know, an armed militia was what you might argue stormed to the Capitol on January 6th. Weapons are unfortunately a powerful antidote against democracy. And every other day, it seems, we see a mass shooting. Some of them are racially motivated. Some are just random violence. And it figures into it, right? It's hard to have a democracy, in particular a multiracial democracy, when a significant percentage of the population is very well armed. It's a frightening proposition.
It's true. It's interesting. The issue of gun control was the issue that led to the ouster of the justices in the Tennessee state legislature after a shooting at a school in Nashville. And so it was the protest in support of those community members who wanted some action to be taken was what led them to be ousted. But I do think it shows that there is, in fact, a multiracial majority of people who, when properly organized and invested in and inspired, can take control of the governing apparatus of the region and state and country, and by extension then take control of the police and law enforcement apparatus and operation. So that, and ultimately, although it was, you know, far later than it should have been in terms of even the January 6th insurrection, it was the government law enforcement forces which did ultimately repel the attack and secure the Capitol. So that's the reality that we face. And so we have to be clear-eyed about the intensity of people who are going to resist democracy, but also be clear that there has to be consequences in utilizing the full power of the state to protect the democracy. And so that really is the battle and the struggle that we're engaged in right now in the country.
Do we need to, alongside building the multiracial democracy, you know, with the model that you've suggested, do we need to find ways also to shift our culture? Because we can't very well write off such a significant portion of conservative whites who are choosing whiteness over democracy. Is part of the plan also to convince people that choosing democracy over white supremacy is in their best interest in the long term too?
Yes, and I think that there's two aspects to that. Part of it is culture, and I think that I'm hopeful in terms of particularly impacting young people, right? So many young people now have had a significant portion of their young lives having a Black man as president. And so that what that does in terms of what's, you know, your sense of possibility and who plays what roles, et cetera, is part of it. I think the other part is that we ultimately need to govern and deliver and change public policies that benefit everybody. And then that and so healthcare is the perfect example of that. There's all this resistance to Obamacare on the theory that this was like a giveaway to Black people. But in point of fact, it made healthcare available to everybody. And there are, in fact, even people who not want to fully acknowledge it, many white people, many white conservatives, many white neo-Confederates who have better healthcare in this country because a Black man pushed through healthcare reform in the federal government. So ultimately, I think that that's the way to maximize the support and reduce some of the opposition is by showing that. And even if you look historically, right, it wasn't that Rosa Parks wanted to desegregate the buses just so Black people could ride. She wanted to desegregate the buses so public transportation would be accessible to everybody. And that is the ultimate goal and objective. And as we advance that mission, there really is really little basis for opposition to it, which is partly why they do so much distorting around what the actual agenda is.
And we've seen life expectancy rates in this country falling. There's been some analysis showing that the places where they're falling, because it's not geographically even, the places where they're falling are the places where Republican-led state-level policies have curtailed access to healthcare, have curtailed access to childcare, and have eroded public education and have eroded the social safety structure. Whereas in states like California and Massachusetts, you're seeing larger life expectancy. I mean, these are facts. Unfortunately, of course, facts don't always play well with a certain minority in this nation. And also we have Democrats themselves, big D Democrats, who are loath to tout the benefits of social justice policies. And I know you've written about this, you've talked about this, you've called Democratic leaders to task over and over again. So let's kind of end with that conversation. How to convince leaders of the Democratic Party that actually articulating their own ideals and standing by them is part of the winning formula to securing a multiracial democracy and ending white supremacy and, frankly, expanding their own political power?
Right. And so, well, part of that is also changing the people in these positions of influence in the Democratic Party and in Democratic campaigns and et cetera, who have this outdated and incorrect understanding. Right. And so Abigail Spanberger is a congresswoman in Virginia, a Democrat, elected in 2018 and reelected in 2020. But she was, you know, a loud, vociferous voice saying that the atmosphere of protest against the police after the killing of George Floyd hurt her politically. And that she's saying all these, you know, the phrase defund the police hurt her politically. When point of fact, she got 54,000 more votes in 2020 than she got in 2018. So how was she hurt politically? But the theory in this, you know, incorrect assumption, this mythology, is very powerful. But I also thought, when I try to lift up, you know, in the epilogue to the book, is in the pandemic, we also saw, you would never have been able to think that, yes, we can just send checks to almost everybody within the country. We can suspend evictions. We can suspend student debt payments. But in the context of the pandemic, we rethought core elements of the social contract and found much greater support for those elements than we've realized existed in the first place. So, ultimately, we have to challenge and push progressive and democratic leaders to do the math, because they're actually not that good at math, in that when you see that a social justice equality agenda, which is in the interest of all people of color who suffer from a profound racial wealth gap within this country, as well as there's a meaningful minority of whites who are supportive of multiracial democracy and justice and equality. But the counters to that, people have too much control over the checkbooks and too little accountability to show how the disproportionate spending on conservative whites is supposedly going to yield results. But we need to continue to push and hold their feet to the fire.
Steve, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck to you. We'll post information about how people can get a hold of a new book from our website.
Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
My guest has been Steve Phillips, founder of Democracy in Color and author of the New York Times bestseller Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. He's also a columnist for The Guardian and The Nation and an opinion contributor to The New York Times and co-host and host of the podcast Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips. His latest book is How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.